is supposed to nourish us, both body and spirit. But when someone's relationship with food becomes damaged and distorted, that eating disorder can interfere with their quality of life, and if not treated, could be fatal. We continue with our ongoing series, Minding Michigan, exploring mental health and wellness issues. Today, we say hello to Dr. Jessica Van Hise, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan and clinical director of the U of M Comprehensive Eating Disorders Program. Good to have you here, Doctor.
Thank you for having me.
So I think most people, it's safe to say, have at least heard of anorexia. They've heard of bulimia. But to be very, very clear, would you explain the differences and then also talk about some of the other kinds of eating disorders that people might not be as familiar with?
Absolutely. And you're exactly right. I think when people think of eating disorders, often what comes to mind is anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa. So anorexia nervosa is when somebody essentially undereats and becomes too low of a weight for their body to be healthy. And along with that comes distorted body image, sort of an inability to perceive that their body doesn't look overweight or obese. They might sort of see themselves as fat, even though they're very malnourished. And also sort of weight and shape take on kind of a central role in their life, so that the things that might matter to all of us, friends, relationships, how we're doing in school or at our jobs, those things sort of become less important than the number on the scale or what they see when they look in the mirror. So it really becomes all-consuming.
And bulimia?
Bulimia, we see similar patterns in terms of weight and shape concerns. And we also see a repeated pattern of binge eating and purging. So that can be via self-induced vomiting, using laxatives, other behaviors such as excessive exercise. On average, people with bulimia are about normal weight or even a little above average weight, whereas in anorexia nervosa, we see that folks are underweight. So that really becomes one of the differentiating characteristics.
And what are some of the other disorders that perhaps might not have quite all the spotlight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even though they don't have the spotlight, they're actually more common. So binge eating disorder is actually the most common eating disorder. So this is when someone engages in repeated episodes of binge eating. And binge eating includes both eating an unusual amount of food given the circumstances. So this isn't Thanksgiving Day when we all kind of indulge a little bit. This is sort of out of the norm, along with a sense of loss of control over eating. So somebody just feels like they can't stop or can't prevent the episode of binge eating from occurring. So it's when we're seeing repeated episodes of binge eating, as well as some similar symptoms that I mentioned for anorexia and bulimia nervosa in terms of a great deal of concern about one's body and a lot of shame and guilt about the binge eating episodes.
Is there also a laxative dependency that people could develop?
People can develop a laxative dependency when those are abused. So we get into cycles where people actually have trouble going to the bathroom without laxatives and need to sort of be weaned off, which gets us really stuck, as you can imagine.
So when you think of how common eating disorders are in this country, what do the numbers tell us?
Well, the numbers tell us that about 0.5 to 1% of women will have anorexia nervosa. So that's actually the most rare eating disorder. Although if we think about other mental illnesses that we often think about, that's kind of on par with, say, schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So or when you think of a group of high school girls, mm-hmm. a class of 400 girls, there's probably four that are going to have anorexia nervosa in that graduating class. Bulimia nervosa, we see numbers kind of in the range of 1 to 3% on average. Binge eating disorder, even more common, 3 to 5%, sometimes higher, depending on the study you look at.
I know. I saw the National Eating Disorders Association had that number of about 30 million Americans are mm-hmm. coping with some kind of eating disorder. And I guess as far as danger, it's worth noting eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness.
Yes, they do.
Why is that?
I think it's because of the combination of effects from eating disorders that we don't see for every other psychiatric illness, just in terms of both the physiological and the psychological consequences of eating disorders. So we know that people with eating disorders have higher rates of suicide than people without mental illness. And we see people die from the medical complications of their illnesses.
We baby boomers will remember singer Karen Carpenter.
Karen Carpenter. I hear that one a lot from people. That's what everybody sort of thinks of. But this is really real and still happening today, mm-hmm. that people are dying of their eating disorders. So we can see all kinds of physiological effects. It really impacts the entire body. Everything from bradycardia, which means our heart rates are slowing down, and other cardiac complications, With repeated binge eating and purging, we can see things like esophageal tears or ruptures. You can imagine the types of difficult consequences that we see. You know, like you said at the beginning, food is supposed to be what nourishes us. And so without it, we can't be well.
Is there a risk profile?
There are certain risk factors that we know increase the likelihood that someone might develop an eating disorder. What we also know is that no single factor tells us who's going to develop an eating disorder. So just because somebody has one or two or even three or four risk factors doesn't necessarily mean they'll develop an eating disorder. And we also see people where it kind of surprises us. Maybe they didn't have so many risk factors that we noticed. But some of the things that we do know about include dieting. So that might sound obvious, but really all of the eating disorders, including binge eating disorder, involve some sort of dietary restriction. Mm. So we see patterns where people might say, I'm just going to try to lose 3 or 5 pounds, something that many of us may have said in our past. But for certain people, they can't stop at just 3 to 5 pounds, and it just keeps going. And we also know that even in the illnesses that involve binge eating, one of the greatest predictors of a binge eating episode is food restriction. So when are we all at most risk to binge eat? When we've been either telling ourselves that we can't have certain types of things or we've been under eating throughout the day.
There's a pretty common view that someone who's most likely to become caught up in an eating disorder is an adolescent girl, probably white. Is that fair? Because I think, you know, just thinking of that kind of feel out there. What do you want to say about that stereotype?
Yeah, I think only one piece of that is true, and that is the word adolescent. Mm-hmm. So we do know that eating disorders tend to have their onset in adolescence, particularly anorexia and bulimia nervosa. Binge eating disorder is a little bit more varied. It can more commonly onset in adulthood. So adolescence is the most common time period that we at least see the onset of eating disorders. The rest of it, I would just say, out the window with those assumptions. We know that eating disorders affect all races and ethnicities, all genders, people of all economic circumstances, just sort of across the board. And we see that when we're treating patients.
Another stereotype I'll let you bust. Is this a choice?
Absolutely not a choice. So I think so many people think that this is just a behavioral problem or just something that if somebody sort of sets their mind to it, so to speak, that they could just sort of
Give it up. Yeah.
Stop right there. And that's just absolutely not what we see. Somebody might make a choice to try to go on a diet. Mm-hmm. Sure, that's a choice that many people have made. But once the eating disorder sort of consumes somebody, it is no longer a choice. The eating disorder is in control of their thinking and their decisions. Just like somebody who's experiencing schizophrenia and might have an episode of psychosis is not making a choice to be psychotic, somebody who's experiencing an eating disorder is not making a choice to have the eating disorder.
So professional treatment is essential. And based on what you've explained about the possible ways that eating disorders can ravage the body, early detection and getting into treatment must be particularly important.
Mm-hmm. I would say the first thing if a parent or a friend is concerned is to get a child into their regular pediatrician or primary care physician, they can take a look at some of those physiological markers that we might be concerned about, as well as weight and sort of how somebody's doing on their growth trajectory. So again, when we're thinking about adolescence, one of the things when you go to your primary care or pediatrician every single year for your well visits is that they'll look at their growth and they'll look at their growth chart. And what we typically see is somebody who's developing normally without any other developmental problems will sort of track along their own trajectory. So somebody that's always sort of been in the 40th percentile for weight and height, we would probably expect them to continue on that track. Somebody that's always been in the 60th, we would probably expect that. So when we see marked variations from that, that's a red flag.
And other symptoms, warning signs that friends and family may notice.
Yeah, so one of the things we commonly see is adolescents sort of declining dinner with the family or making their own separate plate or just seeing portion sizes decline, saying that they already ate, so not eating because, oh, I already had food, but that becoming sort of a persistent pattern. When we're worried about binge eating or purging, sometimes people will find remnants of food that had been consumed and hidden, so finding wrappers in somebody's bedroom or vehicle, for example, and also patterns such as going to the bathroom frequently after eating, laxatives going missing, things like that.
So what are the important do's and don'ts for a concerned parent or a concerned roommate or friend in first bringing up their concerns to to the person?
Yeah, so something that I sometimes talk with people about, contact me and say, I have a friend I'm worried about, what do I do? Sometimes if you enter a conversation with someone saying, I think you have an eating disorder, that sort of puts their defenses up. They feel like they need to defend themselves. Instead, I sometimes suggest just sharing the behaviors you've observed. So, gosh, I noticed that when we went out to dinner the other night, you didn't order. And I saw that happen last week, too. Are you doing okay? Is there something I can help you with?
So what if the person who has probably a very elaborate defense thing constructed says, I'm fine, I'm fine. How do you push beyond that initial shutdown?
Mm-hmm. And I'm fine is probably the response you're going to hear the first time. So eating disorders are also very secretive disorders. Folks don't tend to immediately ask for help. That's especially true for anorexia nervosa. So I'm fine is likely to be the response you might hear. I think just continuing to be persistent and express that you're willing to help. If you're a parent, my recommendation would be to, if you're really concerned, don't listen to I'm fine. Do what your gut as a parent is telling you. If you know that something is going on with your child, and get them to their pediatrician who will help you kind of evaluate the situation and get you into the proper treatment.
So what's the treatment? What are the steps to recovery?
Yeah.
And what's the long-range prospect as far as really getting your arms around this problem?
So there are several different kind of structures for treatment out there, and there are several different treatment approaches out there. What I can say is that no matter what, it needs to involve a physician to monitor medical status. It needs to involve likely a psychologist or a licensed social worker or other therapist to kind of do the therapy piece. And oftentimes we also need to involve a dietitian to help us kind of learn new ways to manage food. The treatment approach that research has the most evidence for when we're talking about treatment of adolescent eating disorders is called family-based treatment. So that's an approach that really involves parents in adequately nourishing and managing eating disorder behaviors. So parents attend every single session and learn. They've always had a healthy child up until the eating disorder sort of hijacked their child's brain. And so just going back to those things that they already know how to do and help them feed their child in a way that's going to sort of promote recovery. And what we really see is for many individuals, once eating normalizes, the intensity of the worries about weight and shape decline just as a result of normalizing the eating patterns. And then we're in a better spot to manage whatever cognitions are still remaining and to sort of use a cognitive behavioral or other therapy approach to work through those.
Do you see many relapses?
We see some. Okay. The literature is mixed on how often it occurs. I think the image that many people have is sort of once somebody has an eating disorder, they're always going to have an eating disorder. And that's not what we see. We see many people achieve full and long-term recovery. Depending on the study you look at, you'll see rates of about 33 to 60% of people achieve full recovery after treatment. Again, depending on the treatment approach used, the diagnoses we're talking about, there are people that need to go through treatment a few times before they achieve long-term recovery.
There are people all over the state of Michigan listening mm-hmm. to us talk now, and it makes me wonder if this is pinging somebody's mind and it's themselves or someone they care about. What's the best way for someone to get fast help where you're not on a, yes, we can take you in the fall, we can take you early next year kind of appointment? How do you get fast help to begin to break the cycle of an eating disorder?
Mm-hmm. And I think this question is so tough because eating disorder specialists are tough to come by. It's such a specialty area. And that's why I suggest a primary care physician or a pediatrician as a quick first step. You can usually get into one of those offices relatively quickly to at least have them help you figure out how severe is this? What level of care do I need? There are different levels of care available. So outpatient treatment involves seeing a therapist and a dietitian and sort of visiting your medical provider, maybe on a weekly or every other week basis, whatever is indicated. There are higher levels of care. So here at the University of Michigan, we have a partial hospital program, which means individuals are with us 5 days a week for treatment, individuals and their families. And there are also residential treatment centers throughout the country. There is not a specialized residential program for eating disorders specifically in Michigan. So when that's indicated, we're talking about going out of state.
Well, we have put a link on our stateside page at michiganradio.org to the National Eating Disorders Association that I know, Dr. Van Hise, you feel is a good source of sound information to get people started researching and answering their questions.
Yes, it's a great resource. I would recommend it to anyone who wants to learn more or is looking for some help of where to start.
Dr. Jessica Van Hise, Clinical Director of the U of M Comprehensive Eating Disorders Program, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.